Wednesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. We have no games today, so we're going to have to talk about the draft and the offseason. Getting to one that I really been looking forward to, Dennis Smith Jr. out of North Carolina. And then we got to talk about the Milwaukee Bucks offseason as well. We're sponsored today by a new sponsor, Quip Toothbrush. Go to quip.com/capspace. Get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush, which I've found to be far superior to more traditional electric toothbrushes in a number of respects, size being a key one of those. And then movement watches, mvmtwatches.com/capspace. Great one for international listeners. They sell in over 160 countries, some really stylish watches at a much less expensive price point than equivalent department store brands. So let's get started with Dennis Smith here. I'll start off with this. I liked him way better than any of these wing prospects that we've looked at so far that are projected to be ahead of him in the draft.
I wouldn't say that I like him way better, but I do have him above them too. And a lot of that for me is based on ceiling, because what Dennis Smith is, I have a little bit of queasiness about, but what he could be is absolutely incredible.
Well, this is where it starts for me with him. I think as far as off the top of my head, you can feel free to argue with me on this, but I think he's probably the most athletic point guard prospect that we've seen since John Wall. And I think that he would be just his rookie year, have better physical tools at point guard, at least on offense, than all NBA point guards, but John Wall, maybe Damian Lillard, although he's got a little size on Lillard. Lillard is pretty explosive, though. I think that's an underrated part of his game. Russell Westbrook, of course, and that's it. I can't think of anyone else who has better physical tools at the point guard position in terms of his athleticism and explosiveness, and you know, still decent size at 6'2", although a slightly smaller than you would hope wingspan at 6'3", but pretty similar size and wingspan to Derek Rose when he came out of school. And I don't know. What do you think of that statement?
I don't have any opposition to it. I haven't run through the full list. This wasn't something we prepared, but intuitively, there's no one else that I wasn't sitting there going, hey, what about blank guy with that? And Smith is special. And that's also incredible when you consider that he tore his ACL at Adidas Nations back in 2015 and yet was still able to make it back and be what he is now.
Yeah, that ACL is a concern. He basically missed his whole senior season. I had actually seen him plenty before that, though. I think three times before that, starting when he was a rising junior at the Adidas EuroCamp in 2014. He was on a team with Thon Maker and Brandon Ingram and Jaylen Brown, who came over and got their butts kicked by the campers who were like, you know, 3 or 4 years older than them at the EuroCamp. But that was definitely really interesting to see him. And he was a year younger than the rest of those guys, of course, at the time. And then saw him at Nations in 2014 and 2015 as well, where he was dominant both times. And then I saw him again last year at Nations, where he's basically making his return, but you know, playing with the college guys, and he was dominant there as well, really stuck out a lot. And so I hadn't looked at him at all this year. He had a very disappointing season from a wins and loss perspective at NC State. Didn't have a ton around him, especially defensively. But you mentioned the ACL, and he definitely just kind of has like his sort of knock kneed, which, because you kind of, the way that you normally tear your ACL is by kind of like an inward type of rotation. You know, if you just think of like the video of Derrick Rose coming to that jump stop and tearing his ACL, like that's kind of what it looks like. I didn't see the play that he actually tore it on Smith at the Adidas Nations. Wasn't watching that particular game. But that gives me a little bit of a concern. Like Tim Hardaway, another guy who tore his ACL, kind of has that same sort of gait. But so that's somewhat of a nebulous factor, you know, but I don't have access to his medical reports. And that's... I mean, I try to do these reports more based on what I see on film, because things like intangibles, which also there have been a few negative reports about him out of NC State when you ask around a little bit, you know, about him just kind of not fitting in as well to the team culture, that type of stuff. But I mean, I'm just basing this on what I see on film, because I don't have access to those reports specifically. I don't have access to the medical reports. And so I don't know how much to judge or not judge there. So these reports are these evaluations are always going to be just what do I see on film. And like I was saying, I think that I like him more than any of these wings to a considerable degree, I would say, actually.
One of the challenges that you think about a lot with particularly athletic ones is their shot good enough to keep teams honest? And while Smith is not, his numbers aren't as ridiculous as Markel Fultz's were, and we talked a little bit on yesterday's show about that we might have some skepticism with his numbers, I think at that basic level, like there are different stages to this, with like Steph Curry being at the higher end, but on the lower end, like as long as teams have to respect your jump shot, you can do fine. fine. I think he exceeds that bar as of now, and I think he can maybe even move up a step or two from that.
36% from three-point range for Smith this year, but there was a huge dichotomy, and then especially when you consider his two-point jumpers as well, which he was awful on. He was under 30% on two-point jumpers. Off the dribble, he was extremely inefficient. But on catch and shoots, he was outstanding. And especially an unguarded catch and shoots, he was 1.5 points per possession. Guarded, he dropped it a little bit, but you know, he had to take some tough shots for this team as well. Also didn't have the absolute greatest shot selection, if we're being honest. But his jumpers off the dribble, he was horrible. 74 points on 107 possessions. That was in the 35th percentile nationally. Only 34.6% adjusted field goal percentage on those. So part of that, I think, maybe is coming off the ACL, because we've seen that guys, especially off the dribble, have not shot well in their first year coming back from an ACL, but also just his form really tends to break down. He's not on balance enough. He doesn't really create the separation, doesn't elevate over guys the way you might hope that he would. But catch and shoots, his jumper looks great, and he's much better there. So he's going to be off the ball, which all point guards have to do to some degree in the modern NBA, I think he'll actually be fine there. He shot 71% from the line, so not amazing, but not like, you know, red flag bad either. So I think that even off the dribble, he'll become a capable shooter in time. I think he actually could get to be like pretty decent as a straight spot up guy, you know, and we'll see how much that changes and what he's able to work on. You know, he's not that old, obviously. He is 19 right now, turns 20 on November 25th. So he's, you know, right about normal age for a guy coming out after his freshman year. The same age as like Karl Towns or Jahlil Okafor when they're drafted, for example. So I think the jumper is going to be okay. He has no floater game at all on floaters. He is not a shot that he tries to look. He wants to get to the basket and he wants to finish, and he finishes very often at the basket in extremely impressive fashion. But on floaters, he took only 14 all year and was 4 out of 14. So again, very inefficient there. Just not a shot that he looks for, and he's not a guy who looks great. Like a shot that he doesn't really have, which I think would be nice if he could create, is like the Russell Westbrook accelerate and then stop and pop from 15 feet, or, you know, even sooner from that, come to a jump stop floater in the lane. You know, he's getting all the way to the rim most of the time, so he's going to need to add that level of refinement. But that's it as far as what I see as major weaknesses for him.
At least on film. One that I would add in, it's a little bit different than that, is he has periodic flashes of like a plus handle, but you don't see it as much possession by possession. I'm not saying he's bad, but when watching him the day after watching Markelle Fultz, you kind of see that difference. That with Fultz, he's a dazzler, and Smith is good. I don't think it's not like he's deficient, but that is something that can really open up separation at the next level. He can also do it through physical tools, and he will probably be able to do that, but it certainly helps.
Yeah, that's interesting. He definitely had flashes, as you said, like of some quick crossovers, in and outs, hesitation dribbles, hang dribbles, and because he's so explosive, I think that he can make that work pretty well. He'll split pick and roll every once in a while. Also in transition, I was very impressed with how little he turns it over. A lot of times point guards won't have great points per possession numbers in transition because they're the ones who always have the ball, and so if there's going to be a turnover that's going to happen on a fast break, it's always them who's committing it. But you know, he wasn't turning it over nearly that much, and he was outstanding in transition, had a lot of possessions in transition as well. So we'll get to what we like about him so much. We started with that already. Right after this from Quip. Quip has rethought everything about an electric toothbrush. I mean, number one, if you don't have an electric toothbrush, I would highly suggest getting one immediately. There are some people who are just still brushing with conventional brushes. My sister invented this term for when you haven't brushed your teeth in a while. She called it sweater teeth because you can just like feel the plaque on your teeth. And I always brush my teeth regularly. I've actually never had a cavity in my life, partially due to genetics, I'm sure, but also hopefully good oral hygiene. And I switched to an electric toothbrush about 3-4 years ago, and now anytime that, you know, I'm traveling and I go back to a conventional toothbrush, I feel like I've got the sweater teeth. Like how much cleaner your teeth feel, how much better your gums are as well. I mean, gum disease can be a really serious problem just for your overall health, not just your gums, because of the effect that the bacteria can have on your whole body. But Quip does an even better job than conventional electric toothbrushes. I have the most famous brand of electric toothbrushes, and Quip is maybe like a quarter of the size of that one. Plus, they really get you on the brush heads. Those are way too expensive. And as a result of that, a lot of people just hold on to those brush heads for too long, and then you're not getting as good of a clean. Another awesome thing about Quip, you don't have to charge it ever. That's what makes up such bulk with some of the other leading brands and makes it really difficult to travel with them as well. Quip is just basically the size of a normal toothbrush, and it just operates on a AAA battery that lasts about 3 months. If you're on their plan, they send a replacement battery with the brush head, and so you don't have to worry about how long the battery is going to last either. It seems like there's almost this planned obsolescence with other electric toothbrushes to where the charge doesn't last as long. And also, that's another reason why it's so easy to take Quip on the road, like, which I travel all the time, because you don't have to worry about bringing that bulky charger with. And it takes up way less space on your bathroom counter as well, especially if you're living in an urban area. A lot of people I know have pretty small bathroom counters. So anyway, I'll tell you more about them because they're doing a whole campaign with us. But I've really been enjoying it. My teeth feel even better than with the electric toothbrushes that I was using before. The way to get started with them, go to getquip.com/capspace and get your first refill pack free with your Quip electric toothbrush. And of course, let them know that you came from us. So that /capspace URL. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/capspace. Once again, getquip.com/capspace. I think you're really going to like this one. This is a massive upgrade over conventional electric toothbrushes, not to mention just the regular old toothbrush that I'm guessing some of you are still brushing with. So once again, getquip.com/capspace. Now, I watched Mike Schmitz's scouting video on Smith, and one of the things that he said about him, he said he's a capable playmaker. I actually would go a little further than that. I thought he was a good playmaker, especially on games where they started a smaller lineup and he was able to play with more space on the floor. Like I watched the game that they played at home against North Carolina where they got smashed, but with more space on the floor, he really was outstanding. He was able to get to the rim. He was scoring over North Carolina's bigs. Really nice hit-ahead passes as well. And while in a stagnant half-court set, especially like if they've kind of passed it around for a little bit and nothing has really happened, he can be forced to take some really bad long twos. Overall, he was efficient on the season. I thought he did a good job just making the right pass out of pick and roll, even when it wasn't necessarily the pass that led to the score. You know, if it's just, all right, we ran the pick and roll, we're going to lift the other big up to the top, and maybe that guy's not wide open for a shot, but I'll just swing it to him just to get the ball moving. You know, I think he had more of those passes than maybe you would have expected with his reputation. You know, he didn't have quite the level, obviously, you know, like a Lonzo Ball type of passer, but, you know, I didn't think that his passing was really that far below where we saw Markelle Fultz. And he had probably, you know, in the film that I watched, 10 or 15, like real wow passes where you're like, oh, I didn't see that ahead of time. This is not the obvious pass to the roll guy. This is actually like throwing a guy open. You know, he'll have some very casual turnovers for sure. But I thought actually his ability to make the right passes was impressive. On the move, maybe he's not quite as good. And that was another thing that I noted as well. I thought that just in general, you know, he's obviously a point guard, he's off the dribble, but the way he attacked in triple threat, both his passing ability, his ability to just take catch and shoot jumpers, and then either, you know, he could jab right and go left. He likes to go left most of the time in ISOs, but he's not too limited from going right. I don't think it's like an issue where it's like, okay, as long as we stop this guy from going left, we got him stopped. That's not the case at all, because he can explode with just a straight right hand drive out of a triple threat extremely well, or same thing out of a hesitation dribble, and finishes just fine. A little bit better with the right hand, but still solid with the left hand. It's got a lot of like nice double pump finishes, hang in the air, bounce off the big type of plays. He's a little too aggressive sometimes. Like he thinks he's Superman at the rim and he's going to be able to score everything. Like I'd like to see a little bit more drive and kick type of play from him, especially when he gets right at the basket. So he could stand to be a little bit more in control instead of over penetrating and going into three guys and just hoping to get fouled or throw up some miracle shot, which he is capable of making on occasion, but you know, he could just be a little bit more judicious there.
There are a couple different levels to being a college point guard that you really want to see, and you brought up a couple of them during that. One is the ideal is that they can see passes that we don't see. Some of that is also just the angles, but other things. And he does that sometimes. I think you saw more of it than I did. You also watch more film of him than I have. But he also does a good job of seeing, making the right pass that is there. And it might sound basic, but that is incredibly important. And there are some talented guys who just don't do that often. And I feel pretty comfortable with Dennis Smith in that way. And then the turnovers, I think, can be improved with time. But I really, like with Fultz, I'm excited to see him not only with better teammates, which will be important, but with a more cohesive overall system. And just the idea of, okay, these are the reads, these are where the guys should be. And NBA teams, that's part of the reason why being a point guard takes so much time, is that it's a lot to learn, it's a lot to take in, it's a lot to adjust to. But I think Smith can benefit from that more than some other guys who've come into the league.
Yeah, like, for example, what they would, NC State would try to run, like, the Spain pick and roll set, where they have a small, their best shooter, this guy Maverick Rowan, would set a back screen on the defender of the big who had set the initial pick and roll. And Smith didn't really seem to have much understanding of how to operate in that set, or really, you know, what the point of it was, you know, that he really needed to make sure there was a good screen and then put pressure on the rim that, you know, the big defender was getting screened, you know. And they would run that, and it's harder to run that with college spacing than NBA spacing too, but they never really seemed to get much good out of that, because in part because he would just, you know, they would run that play and then he would just like take a long two that wasn't really open, or you know, wouldn't really try and attack the rim with the idea of like what the point of the play was, you know. So there were definitely times where, you know, he didn't really seem to have like quite the level of acumen there, but you know, he's also a freshman point guard. I mentioned that he doesn't get a ton of separation on his off the dribble jumpers. He kind of brings the ball up in front of his body a little bit as well when he shoots off the dribble, not as bad as like a Josh Jackson, but that I think also was part of why. And just his, the way he would land on his off the dribble jumpers, he was kind of all over the place, you know. He's gonna have to clean that up, hopefully. I do think he could have some ability as a post-up player. We didn't see him really in the post much, but with his athleticism, I think he's going to get a lot stronger too, where he's going to be able to really go through guys, and he's just so athletic that he can just pop over guys for a floater. He had one play where he got the ball at the elbow and shot like a nice fadeaway jumper out of the post. I'd like to see some more Euro step game from him as well. We saw some hints of that, but it's not really something that he did a ton of. But I mean, if you were going to compare him to most point guards who are as athletic as him that have come out, like a John Wall or a Russell Westbrook, I mean, he doesn't have like the length, quite the length or the bounce of those guys. You know, he's not going to dunk over guys at the rim. He's not quite that level. You know, but he's an alley-oop threat. He throws down some really nice dunks in transition or in the half court if he's unopposed. But his jumper, compared to like guys like Westbrook and Wall when they came out, is much ahead of where they were at that point.
And it needs to be, because the league is going in that direction. And there are threshold markers there, but I think he can reach that. And what excites me about Smith is that I think the player that he is right now is productive and useful. And remember that you need 48 minutes from primary ball handlers, ideally ones. But what if he can iron out like some of the bigger things or some of the smaller things, he becomes so much better so quickly.
Yeah, and he gets to the rim so fast, and he's so explosive when he gets there. And just when you consider that level of explosiveness that he has, like I would say like his passing and shooting are above average. Now, he's got to learn how to change speeds a lot. He's got to learn how to get guys on his back in the pick and roll, and then that crazy explosion could be even more effective, you know, once he's able to kind of slow down and then speed up it again. He's all, you know, 1,000 miles an hour at this point. I think he also could be really dangerous as a cutter. You know, he wasn't really that active off ball. I thought just in general, actually, probably needs to get in a little bit better shape, both from a body composition standpoint and also cardio. You know, like he really got winded towards the end of the first half of that North Carolina game. But all that said, I thought his defense was, he definitely has the ability. Like he's got great ability with steals. When he jets after a loose ball, like, and actually really goes for it, it's like, you're like, wow, he just went and got that and took it away from someone. He's solid on the defensive glass. Again, you know, it's a question of getting in there and jumping, but you know, he's not afraid to get up there, and he can really sky for some of these defensive rebounds. And he had a solid defensive rebound rate. I think it was about 12%. He also didn't have, you know, an unbelievable amount of effort for a freshman point guard coming off an ACL tear on a terrible defense. But I did, like, unlike Markel Fultz, I didn't look at him and be like, all right, he is one of the big problems with this defense. You know, I think he can get down and slide when motivated. You know, if he wants to like heat up the ball in the full court, he can do that. I mean, I don't think he's going to get into like the type of shape, and you know, given what his likely offensive role is going to be, he's probably not going to do a ton of that. But he's capable of doing that. He's capable of moving his feet. And then he has a great anticipation for steals, had a really high steal rate. I think at one point he was leading the ACC in both assists and steals. I think he might have finished second in the conference in steals. So I just think he has a ton of upside. Like, he could, he's a guy where you look at him and you're like, with his physical tools and some of the abilities that he has, like, seeing him as a top 5 point guard in the league someday is not totally unrealistic to me. You know, it's always going to be questionable whether anyone can get there, but he has the tools to do that. Whereas when you're talking about like Tatum, Josh Jackson, maybe Jonathan Isaac does, but he's got a long way to go at it in the ways that we talked about. I like Isaac the best out of those three guys, as we talked about, but I think that just Smith has so much more upside, even if those guys do play a slightly scarcer position. And just having a great point guard is such an incredible advantage in the NBA that I would be, I'm not saying that like the Sixers should take him or something like that necessarily, because you wonder about the fit with Ben Simmons. And at some point maybe we'll do like a mock draft of the top 10 once we really get through all these guys and really think about the team needs and stuff. But yeah, I mean, this guy has so many wow plays where you're just like, man, like, this guy has a ton of upside.
There has been conversation, though it is reduced in recent years, considering Stephen Curry and Kyrie Irving are the last two point guards of title teams. But there was this whole thing about, oh, you don't need a point guard to win a title. But when you look at it, the teams with the best ones almost always make the playoffs. And that's not even using the bias of, those teams, those point guards being considered the best because their teams win. I mean, you can think about somebody like Chris Paul and the way that he has elevated different talent levels, and you could go in a lot of different directions. I'm not saying Smith is at that level, but there is so much value to that. And you don't see that same thing with bigs for sure. And with wings, it depends. I mean, the elite of the elite, certainly. But outside of that, it becomes shakier. So the value part of it, if he can reach, like starter, above average starter level, is incredible. And remember, he's on a rookie scale contract for 4 years, and then you have match rights. So if you can get that player locked in, it's fantastic to have. And if the worst case scenario is that he, maybe he doesn't reach that level and he's a good backup or something like that, that's still useful at the level that he's going to get paid.
Well, the worst case scenario is that he gets injured again. And
yeah, that's true.
That, especially because of the way that he plays and the way that I think that he has to play, that if he has a decline in his athleticism, then, he becomes a much less effective player. And the one thing I do like about him too is his potential off the ball, not just running a pick and roll from the top of the key, that he can catch the ball and triple threat, even just be like an ISO threat from like 20 feet or so, because he's just a much better shooter just at a standstill. And also his ability from triple threat to blow by guys, I thought was really impressive and explosive. But we'll see what happens there. I mean, so would you take him over the three wings that we've looked at so far? Not counting Fultz, but Isaac, Tatum, and Jackson.
In the abstract, like if we were starting a team from scratch, yes. There are specific squads where I wouldn't necessarily do that, but that's not a fair way to evaluate it, because you can't say, oh, well, he's worse because he's not as good fit for the Sixers. That's not fair. So yeah, I would have him like in an idealized rankings, I would have him above those three guys.
Yeah, and to me, I think when you're talking about like the tiers system where you say, okay, it will take into account need if we have these guys in the same tier, I would have him in a tier above all those guys. This is, of course, just based on the film, right? Again, I mean, there's a weird point in the North Carolina game where he was guarding like Joel Berry on the wing. Berry entered the ball in to someone in the post, and before the guy had even scored for North Carolina, like Dennis Smith was just like pointing at the bench and like almost started walking over towards the bench, like while the play was still live. And then like right after that, he got taken out, and then they put him back in afterwards, and he ended up scoring like 17 points in the first half or something. But it was just very odd. And in that game too, there was like, after he came back in, he had some bad body language when like guys didn't throw in the ball when he thought they're supposed to and stuff like that. But again, it's kind of speculation to say like how much that should matter, and I'm not going to give that or the injury a ton of weight in these rankings. So if teams can do that, they have access to more of that stuff than I do, but I am going to just rank it based on the information that I have available.
Just to tie up one loose end, he did finish first in the ACC in assists with 6.2 per game. He finished second to Donovan Mitchell in steals at 1.9.
Oh yeah, because Louisville is in the ACC.
Conferences are just such BS now.
All right, we'll get to the Milwaukee Bucks offseason. But first, this from our friends at Movement Watches, MVMTWatches.com. MovementWatches.com/capspace is your URL to get 15% off your purchase with them. Movement Watches were started by two broke college kids that wanted to wear stylish watches, but they couldn't afford them. The belief that they had is that style shouldn't break the bank, and that's appealed to me as well, because I always felt like, why would I spend $400 or $500 on a watch, like, which was really how much I would have had to spend in past years to find a watch that I actually really liked. Movement Watches, however, start at just $95. That is a fraction of what department store brands typically charge. And you might think, all right, that's pretty inexpensive for a watch. How good can they be? I really encourage you to go to that URL, mvmtwatches.com/capspace, and just take a look at them. It's beautiful, styled minimalism. I think you'll find one that you really like if you go to that URL. And that, of course, will get you 15% off today, and let them know that you came from us as well. They make a great gift. I got one for my mom. She actually got one for my cousins, her nieces as well. So both men's and women's, they have fantastic styles. And if you're an international listener trying to support the pod, they sell them in over 160 countries. They've sold over 500,000 watches overall. So once again, way to get started with them, movementwatches.com, mvmtwatches.com/capspace is the URL to get 15% off today, plus free shipping and free returns. Join the movement. Well, the Bucks had an interesting 2016 offseason. I don't think that's going to happen again in 2017.
Well, they have Palace intrigue this year. That's fun.
Yeah, I guess that we should discuss that with John Hammond leaving. It had been reported basically that Justin Zanuck was going to come over there and he would probably be Hammond's successor. Now, though, Mark Stein and Woj both reporting, and to various degrees, that the Bucks are actually going to open up their GM search. They will be hiring a search firm to do the search for them. Zanuck still will have a chance to interview, and it may even be the favorite there, but that is very interesting to see. Maybe they're going to see, you know, if David Griffin becomes available or something, maybe they would try and go after him or something along those lines. I mean, and I think part of this, the reason that they're doing this, and there may be some more internal Palace intrigue than we realize, is that after Giannis took this amazing leap this year, and after they made the playoffs, I think they think that their GM opening might be more appealing. And also they realize how important this is as well, as they now have this potential championship player. I think Zanuck is very capable, and I would have no problems with him getting that job, but it'll be interesting to see who else they end up interviewing there in Milwaukee. But Zanuck will retain his assistant GM role for now, and is the interim GM for the moment. So he's running things for the time being. Let's start with what their cap situation is.
So their cap situation depends a lot on Greg Monroe. Greg Monroe has about an $18 million player option. But so either way, it's 17.9, close to damn enough. And either way, they're not really going to have much cap space to work with, especially when you consider the more lucrative mid-level exceptions now than they used to be. But what Monroe opting out would give them, they would lose a capable player on a one-year contract. What it would give them is the flexibility to not really worry about the luxury tax this season.
If Monroe were to opt in, they also have Tony Snell as a restricted free agent. If we were to assume generously that he were to sign a contract starting at $10 million a year, that's probably too generous, actually. Maybe it's 12, maybe it's 13. You're basically right at the tax, a little bit over, with their existing commitments, including the number 17 draft pick that they have. They would want to re-sign, or they'd want to sign maybe their second round pick as well. They've got Gary Payton on a 9 guarantee, but not a ton of flexibility. Spencer Hawes also has a player option for $6 million. I would expect him to opt into that, but maybe he'll opt out. Who knows? So that's if Monroe opts in. I mean, and so this does not seem like a team that's going to pay the tax, particularly before their new arena opens. So if Monroe opts in, you're probably just looking at like minimum signings, basically, to if they're going to avoid the tax, unless they can move someone. Either Hawes might be someone who they could move. But I think the guy who's really superfluous is John Henson, who, you know, hasn't really looked like even a quality backup center option, and he's making $10 million a year basically for the next 3 years, though his contract does decline slightly.
Yeah, they have these three players that they have signed in recent years, Henson, and then last summer they signed Mirza Teletovic and Matthew Dellavedova. It doesn't look like any of those guys are starters in the present or in the future for the team. And Henson, I would say, is the worst combination of player and contract of those three. And yeah, moving,
and position as well, yes, because there's a billion centers on the market, right, these days.
So if they really needed to face a squeeze, they could maybe find a taker for one of those three. And then what they would probably end up doing is using the mid-level exception exception to fill in that gap with a less expensive player. But that could be palatable for them, depending on what the offers are and who they think they can get on the open market. The challenge, as always, with those kinds of things, because people suggest this all the time, is the issue of timing. Because you have to find a taker probably in the earlier part, and you have to find somebody who wants your money in the earlier part. And the longer you wait, the narrower the supply gets of both trade partners and potential fits.
Yeah, and maybe you could see them signing some guys and then just trying to avoid the tax later in the year. But that's kind of risky for this team, which it cannot pay the tax, especially because you would think that what they really should be focusing on is like 3 years from now, when Giannis will actually be 25 and in his prime, and they'll figure out what the hell is going on with Jabari Parker. I mean, that's another thing we can talk about. But before we kind of get into what they need and some of the specific free agents, their 2018 space is also very interesting, right? Because Jabari Parker, his cap hold is about $20 million. You would imagine that the chances of him extending are pretty low, but you could see him, let's say he comes back right around January, February of next year, looks okay, not amazing, but good enough that you think like, all right, you know, he can still be a starter for us in the future with some upside. You know, maybe he re-signs for $20 or $25 million. Even with Monroe leaving, they are right at the cap for next year, and that doesn't include Tony Snell, who, and there's basically $20 million essentially between the cap and the tax over these next few years. So then Snell, you know, 12 million of that gap between the cap and the tax is probably taken up by him. And so then you look into any contracts that you sign for longer than a year, and you're worried about the tax again, even if Monroe leaves after next year, after opting in this year. So even if Monroe were to leave this year, you're still kind of constrained worrying about your finances in the 2018 offseason. So you probably, you know, do you want to sign someone to the full mid-level for a four-year contract? Probably not, especially because, again, I think they should be focusing on 2019, 2020, 2021. And so you don't want to sign someone to longer than maybe a two-year deal, because that player is just due to the nature of free agency and how old they are mostly. That player probably will be a bad contract or a non-contributor by the time this team is really ready to contend in the Eastern Conference. So it's a major concern for them. And so I really don't see, unless they get extremely creative, or maybe they trade their first round pick and try to get another contributor and also dump salary at the same time. That might be the type of move they would try to do, you know, kind of similar with Henson to what Brooklyn and Washington did with Andrew Nicholson and Bojan Bogdanovic, where they could get a contract that ends sooner.
The way the Rockets did the Lou Williams, Corey Brewer trade, where they basically gave up a first round pick to trade a negative asset for a positive one.
Yeah,
but I wanted to tie it in because I thought you were setting the table for what makes the Bucks also really compelling, is that you talked about how it sets up for 2018. The same thing happens again in 2019, because in 2019, Chris Middleton has a player option for $13 million that he's probably going to decline. So then you have to deal with that. And that's the year that Malcolm Brogdon is a restricted free agent. While his cap hold is low, his payment presumably is going to be a lot higher, especially a lot higher than it is right now. So they have these issues where like a guy pops off the books like Toledovich or like Greg Monroe, but they already have the player lined up to fill that hole in salary.
Yeah. 2019 is a little easier because Toledovich would come off the books at that time, and Henson and Dellavedova would be in the last years of their deals at that point. So maybe they would be movable, though. Yeah, you did mention Brogdon as well as guys that they have to resign. So yeah, that it could get interesting at that point too. And this now is a perfect example of how this new, more restrictive tax really hurts small markets, a team that, you know, just does not seem like a luxury taxpayer. Maybe they'll be wrong once they get into the new stadium, or if they get close or whatever, or Giannis is just an unbelievable superstar. But if this is the New York Knicks, we got Giannis, we're getting close, we think there's a guy at the full mid-level who can help us get over the top, absolutely, go ahead, sign him, we'll pay the tax. Golden State Warriors, LA Lakers, go ahead, sign him, we'll pay the tax, right? Under the old regime, when it was just a dollar for dollar tax before the 2011 CBA, teams could go into the tax, and it wasn't so prohibitive, right? They could still do it, even if they were, you know, for $10 million or so, it's just an extra $10 million. Like, that's something you can, like, actually swing if you're a small market and like, all right, yeah, maybe we won't profit as much for this year or the next year, but like, it's not prohibitive. Now, if you're a small market team trying to go into the tax by $10 or $15 million, unless you have like Paul Allen as your owner who just says like, fuck it, I'll just pay it. And we don't even know if he's going to do that given where they are as a team. But now just like small market teams feel like they can't do that at all. And so that's why they're a perfect example. They're going to be, for the next 4 or 5 years, they're going to be doing this dance with the tax that basically is going to function as a hard cap for them. And we could see them have to give up assets to get off a salary. Now, you know, you could certainly make the argument that they signed some very dumb contracts over the last 3 years that have put them in this predicament. But, you know, not every contract is going to be great. And that's why this, oh, more punitive luxury tax, like that'll help small markets. No, it's the exact opposite.
And the Bucks are even a team that if they get to reach kind of their championship potential, the repeater tax could end up being a really punitive issue for them too. And they're a team that you don't want to dissuade in that area as well, you know, because they're going to be called off of spending it this time because they're probably going to want to say, save those chips for later on in case they end up reaching the level that we all hope they reach.
How fucked would they be if they had been able to move Plumlee?
I'm a little bit amazed it took us this long to get here because, yeah, their situation, because they replaced Plumlee with Spencer Hawes, who has he's about half the salary, but he's expiring this year. And then Roy Hibbert, who's already gone. They didn't even have to pay him for that whole year because they dumped him on the Phoenix Suns. So they
Denver
would
Nuggets.
Denver Nuggets. Same thing. No, they're not. Adam's going to get mad at me.
He played about as much for the Nuggets as he played for the Suns.
As Jared Sullinger played for the Suns. Yeah.
Yeah.
but so they would be completely screwed. They would like all these choices about, oh, maybe they could use this, maybe they could use that. They would be looking to dump salary right now. They would probably be attaching assets because they would have to. They wouldn't be looking at it kind of as a luxury. They would be looking at it as a necessity. Maybe they'd be giving up Tony Snell, all those sorts of things.
And it's funny because I actually think the full mid-level exception is going to like not be like that can actually get you someone. I think this year and especially next year now when we see the cap really flattening out, and it's shocking already how many teams are running into tax concerns just 1 year after the cap went up, just because they were all like so fiscally irresponsible in the summer of 2016. And this is another one of those ones where, like, other than Plumlee, like, we didn't hate their offseason that much, you know, in 2016. We thought Teletovic, all right, you know, that's pretty much market rate, 3 years, 30 million. Dellavedova, 4 for 38, not that bad. But I mean, if you had a 3 year, $30 million contract to give out this year, and they wouldn't, now keep in mind, they wouldn't had all this money to spend this year because Giannis's price is going up so much. But if they had 3 years, 30 million or 4 years, 38 million to give out this year, I'm guessing they probably could have done better than Teletovic or Dellavedova in this market. And then in 2018, it gets even better than that.
Do you want to hear the guy that I thought of when I was writing my SI piece would be a really good fit for them? Not saying he's going there, but who I thought would be a fun fit.
Okay.
James Johnson.
Hmm.
The idea being that he could play with either Giannis or Parker, defend the better guy, shoot enough to make it work, and give them a little bit of an edge.
I don't think I like that one as much because I'm not sure how real his shooting is. Age 30, so I mean, you're probably going to have to go at least 3 years for him. I would guess that's something close to like the full MLE, if not maybe even a little bit higher. So he's not going to be good by the time you're ready to go again. He's very duplicative just size-wise, which is nice to be able to switch and stuff, but it's just a few, like one too many combo forwards. Like I think they need more. My identification of what they need is ideally, and it's fun because they do have like a lot of depth. And if you're going to say that Thon Maker is going to be their starting center next year, like they don't really have any positions that have a glaring need even without Parker. And if he comes back, I mean, that's the other problem too, right? In determining what they need, especially in the long term, is, you know, Jabari Parker is going to be your number two offensive option and creator. That's great. If he's not going to be able to come back and do that, and he's not going to be able to stay healthy, then you really probably need someone who's more dynamic, especially a point guard. But, you know, obviously that player is difficult to acquire, but that, you know, they could use someone who could just get in. I think actually, you know, we talked about Derrick Rose with the Spurs, and actually an interesting aside here, Ian Begley, Knicks reporter for ESPN, reported today that the Knicks are interested in re-signing Rose, but that the T-Wolves with Tom Thibodeau, his former coach, would also be interested, and that actually there might be some interest from the Spurs, quote unquote, depending on the market. And he also had the caveat that executives believe that he could be a fit there, as opposed to that, you know, it's actually coming from any of the parties specifically. But so, all right, I guess we kind of got that one right on Rose when we were speculating there. But I think Rose actually, you know, he's 90 miles away from Chicago, which he probably would enjoy, and he wouldn't need to get more than a 1 year deal. Hopefully maybe it would be something where he'd get a 1 year deal with a second year player option, but I think he actually could give them something that they need, as just another guy who can get into the lane and really draw help. His lack of shooting would be a concern, and also the fact that they have two other point guards, but then you could play Brogdon more at the two as well. I think he even could guard threes okay due to his strength, you know, as long as it's not too dynamic of a guy. guy. So that would be the type of guy I'm looking at for, but they don't have, it's going to be hard for them to get better other than just internal improvement because they don't really have any positions where they just suck right now.
It's also hard because of the idea with Jabari Parker to figure out what they should do on the wing, because if they have Parker, Giannis, Middleton, and Snell, they don't really need much. Like, those guys are all quite good, and there isn't a really natural fit, especially if they're going to keep Teletovic, kind of like, okay, well, this is a clear-cut need. I mean, if you could get a small forward who can shoot, that would be wonderful, but it's not necessarily required. So yeah, I had trouble with that as well. And the other option would be just to get, and I think this is what they should use one of their draft picks on, is just get a high ceiling guy at basically any position and just hope they work out, because you can make it fit with what they have.
Yeah, again, I'm not as familiar with the guys in the mid-teens, but I think actually ironic, because they have four centers on the roster right now and they're paying some of them quite a bit, but Monroe, either he opts out this year, and we'll get to talking more about him, either he opts out this year or he then becomes a free agent next year, and it's hard to imagine him coming back given what their tax concerns are, the fact that Parker will need a raise, etc. They've got Hawes still and Henson, who's going to be around for a while, but either you think would be traded or just isn't that good. So I actually think probably what makes the most sense, and there's a lot of centers available at this point in the draft at 17, would be trying to find another cheap, low-cost center who maybe stylistically could work well with Thon Maker, just a guy who's got a little more strength, a little more defensive rebounding capability, maybe does more on the offensive glass, that type of player who's maybe just a little bit more of a traditional option than Maker, just who could be kind of cheap labor as a backup center if they're able to move on from Henson. And just even also Henson and Maker just aren't that good of a fit because they're both real thin as well. So I think having just another stylistic option there would be the most realistic for them. I mean, they're one of the few teams I look at that actually could use a center at this point.
The other guy, I don't think he's going to fall this far. Granted, I haven't watched as many of these guys, is if he doesn't have just like something catastrophic on his medical report, the idea of rolling the dice on Harry Giles for them is pretty brilliant, because it's just a lottery ticket. And if it works, then you have this kind of a piece that could be a part of an incredibly successful team. And if it doesn't, he's not that expensive. You probably weren't going to get somebody as good at your spot, so not that big a deal.
Let's get to Monroe now. If you were him, would you opt out? He will be 27.
My instinct is that I would not, because I don't think his value is going to drop off a cliff during this year. But he, more so than maybe any single player in this free agent, it's him and Rudy Gay, or these two guys, their agents are going to make their money on advising on this decision, because they have to talk to teams, they have to really see what the market is, because all it takes is one, but it's going to be so damn hard for any center to find that one team this year.
Well, let's just take a look at it, right? He's making $18 million. So does he make $18 million, or close to damn enough that it makes no difference, as a certain great podcaster would say. Here are the teams that I project right now, and this can change, obviously, based on who comes back, etc., as potentially having $18 million or more in cap space. Boston doesn't want him, doesn't need him. Maybe they could. Actually, that's not... I could see them maybe just striking out on everyone and signing him, but would they want to tie up flexibility in him for a long time? They got to go up against Cleveland. Monroe's a terrible matchup against Cleveland. Probably not. Brooklyn, and they already got Brook Lopez. They don't need a guy who's as old and slow as Monroe. Chicago, probably not going to have the space, and if they did, they already got Robin Lopez. Denver, they got two centers already, and if they wanted to get a center, they'd want someone who's better defensively. Houston, unlikely to have the space, and I doubt that they, again, when they have to compete with the Warriors, San Antonio, like they're going to try and upgrade defensively. I don't think they'd be interested. Indiana, they got Miles Turner already. The Lakers, they're hoarding their cap space for 2018. Miami, they already got Hassan Whiteside. Minnesota, they got Karl Towns and Gorgui Dieng. The Knicks, maybe, but probably not. They got massive need at point guard. Orlando, billion centers already. Philly, billion centers already. Phoenix, possibly, but doesn't seem like the type of guy that they would really be going for. Sacramento, not really at that point. They got a million centers already. Yeah, I think I'd opt in.
And really, okay, so what kind of contract? Because you also have to say that part of the reason you opt out is because you can choose your own place and maybe you can go somewhere that you have a better chance, whether that's as a starter or on a competitive team, whatever you want to go with. What kind of money would you be looking for to say, okay, opting out is the right decision? Like three for 35, does that do it for you? Does it need to be more than that, like 340?
Yeah, I think it would have to be at least 340 for me. And, you know, I don't know that the market's going to be any better in 2018, but I think he's going to say certainly like a four-year deal for the full MLE is not getting it done. That's only basically like $35 million over 4 years. So, no, I think I would. I mean, there's nothing out there for him, I don't think, unless he just like, all right, I really want to go to a winner. And this is, remember, he just experienced his first crack at the playoffs, and they should make it again next year, you would think, unless there are injuries. So, no, I would imagine that he's going to stay put. And that's, if he does, that's going to make their offseason very uninteresting unless there's a trade to move some money.
The other option that could be there for them is that Monroe, if he opts in, becomes an interesting trade asset because he doesn't have years on his contract. So what you could see is a circumstance where a team looks at the center market, let's say Taj Gibson, who can be a power forward slash center, or Deadman, or whoever else, and they go, well, we'd rather have just a one-year guy, get them on a trade. And so what you're probably not going to do is trade that guy into cap space. That, I don't think that's a reasonable possibility. However, there could be an opportunity where somebody else just has a different asset, you know, like maybe a wing guy that they don't like very much, or, you know, somebody like that. I'm not saying Terrence Ross is at this level. He's just the first guy. And of course, Orlando's a terrible fit, but just a guy who maybe Pat is like right on the edge of the asset test, that you go in and they say, well, we'd rather have a center on an expiring contract than that guy. And the Bucks see that same calculus the other way due to their positional needs. I haven't gone through it to see who that team would be, but I think that's a possibility too.
Yeah, and maybe they could do a sign and trade or something. They get a guy who's going to be a free agent this year and trade back Monroe, but it's still, I'm not even sure what the team is that would really want Monroe. I mean, because maybe there's a team that would say, all right, you know, Monroe can help us for 1 year, you know, at $17 million, and we have an outgoing free agent that we're not going to re-sign, so we can just trade him to the Bucks and we'll get Monroe. But that again, very difficult to make those kind of deals work very well. Tony Snell, restricted free agent, had a breakout year. They certainly kicked ass in that trade because Michael Carter-Williams probably won't be returning to Chicago, you would imagine. Where do you see him? My thought is that he's kind of, you know, a lower-end starter, high-end backup type of player. But, I mean, as a guy who's a quality defender who can make threes, there's not too many of those guys to go around, even if he is totally powerless off the dribble.
I pretty much agree with that. I worry a little bit about whether this year's sample was representative kind of both parts of the 3-and-D. I'm not saying he's bad, but just... maybe you don't expect him to grow.
You know, I think the outlier actually was his 2015-16 season. I thought that he actually showed promise the year before that in
that's interesting.
Some limited minutes.
I could see that.
But in terms of his shooting, you know, I think I believe in his shooting. I think he could be a quality, if not 40% three-point shooter, which I think he was last year, you know, high 30s. And, like, I mean, he's not strong enough to really be an elite defender, and he's not, doesn't have the bounce to be an elite defender, but certainly as a quality option, and, you know, someone who can switch 1 through 3 adequately. I think, you know, there's really not that many players to go around. You know, you're not, and it wasn't like in the playoffs that like he was getting exploited somehow. They had to guard him. I thought he was good enough in the playoffs that you weren't like, oh, we're gonna, like, this guy can't play when the going really gets tough.
And as you said, there are a lot of teams that can benefit from just a low usage steady hand like that, whether they're using them as a starter or coming off the bench. I mean, I'm not saying they're the ideal fit, but think about what he could do to help Minnesota's wing rotation. Just a guy who could fill in a lot of their gaps and help out.
Yeah, I don't think Tom Thibodeau will be too interested in Snell personally, but I agree with you. I think he actually could be helpful there.
I would rather have him on the contract that I think he's going to get than Derrick Rose on Minnesota.
So perhaps due with their tax concerns, I mean, I think they'll probably match anything that's reasonable. And if you were another team, I mean, I'm thinking like what's fair for him, $10 million on the low end over 4 years, maybe $12-13 million on the high end would be fair. You know, that's the type of offer I'd be making in to keep him out of restricted free agency, essentially, you know, on July 1st, like that'd be the range I'd be offering as the Bucks. But if you're another team, I mean, would you go like $16 million for Tony Snell, or is that just completely insane?
I wouldn't, because it's hard to see him becoming so much more than he is. Like, he doesn't have anything really off the bounce, and I don't see him being this like lockdown defender guy. And so if you're not going to recheck either of those boxes, it gets hard to really reach into that range unless you are truly elite at what you do well. And he's very good, and I think he deserves credit for that, but he's not elite. He's not Danny Green.
No, I agree with that. He is 25 right now, so you're getting him really for his prime years. Of the teams with significant space I could actually see him being a solid fit in Indiana, depending on what happens with Paul George. If they're going to, actually, even not depending on what happened with Paul George, potentially. I could see Philly potentially having a use for him as just a 3-and-D guy. Although, you know, I think they hope that Timothée Luwawu-Cabarrot can turn into him with maybe a little more off the bounce game. Sacramento, probably not. They already got Buddy Hield, who they're trying to develop right now. Phoenix already has Devin Booker. So, yeah, I don't see Orlando already. As Evan Fournier. So these cap space teams, the Knicks have Courtney Lee, but maybe they would try to move Lee and sign Snell, but probably not. Again, they got to get a point guard. Minnesota, Tibbs probably doesn't want him. Miami could be a possibility if they and Deion Waiters aren't able to agree on a contract. They got plenty of guys who can dribble on that team, but still, you know, they got Josh Richardson and Tyler Johnson and Goran Dragic. So they probably don't need another shooting guard because Snell can't really guard the best threes. So I'm not really sure what the destination is for him that's gonna pay him a ton of money. So maybe the thought is that the Bucks can squeeze him a little bit and maybe they get him, you know, on that 4-year $40 million deal, something like that.
How do you feel about, I guess it's just because they have too many duplicative talents, about the idea of the Nets just throwing, because the problem with it, so he's turning 26 at the start of next season, so I think he's a little bit too old for where we think they're gonna peak, but I think they're probably the most logical of those targets.
Yeah, that would be a thought too, because they don't really have any kind of a two guard. I know that you hate Joe Harris passionately, Danny. You have
not nearly as much as no. I think hate is only left for Joffrey LaVerne. I think he's the only guy that I can think of that gets that. I do not think Joe Harris is necessarily a great player, but you know, at a certain point, you want. I'm not saying they should like cut him or anything crazy like that. Anyway, we can talk about Joe Harris another time.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you could see Boston if they strike out on everybody and they say, hey, you know, we need a two who can replace Avery Bradley or something, but you know, I that seems very unlikely to me as well. So yeah, I mean, that would be my projection, that he's, you know, returns to Milwaukee, and that's a number that I think they can live with, especially if Jabari then comes back and you've got Snell to back up either wing position. And he's, you know, his length, his ability to switch in a pinch, you know, I think that fits into a lot of what they should be able to do eventually with this team, especially if Brogdon is going to be the starting point guard. Like, their switchability should be very high. I've really 1 through 5. If you got Thon Maker at the 5, that would really be outstanding. Anything else you wanted to talk about with them? I think I'm pretty close to done here.
I don't think there's anything more on the Jabari Parker extension, but we should just talk about how fascinating a conversation that is, because he tore his ACL, I think it was February 8th. I heard a 12-month recovery is last time, so they would have to negotiate that without seeing him back even close to 100%.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be 8 months basically by the start of training camp, so they'll have an idea. I mean, he'll probably have resumed basketball activities by that point, although I'm sure they will be incredibly conservative with him this time in terms of actually returning NBA games. Probably the best analog for him would be Steph Curry, and Curry had that ankle surgery. Nobody really knew if he was going to be able to come back. They hadn't seen him healthy at all when he signed the extension. He got basically $11 million a year. That was when the cap is half of what it is right now, essentially. So, you know, something like $20 million a year. And I think we could probably say that Steph at that point had showed about what Jabari had showed when healthy. But this, of course, now is the second ACL injury in the same knee for Parker, which is probably more concerning even than those Steph ankle injuries, and Jabari more reliant on athleticism as well. So if you wanted to think of what I really would be willing to take a risk on, and I'm not saying Jabari Parker has any chance of turning into as good a player as Steph Curry did, but what I was going to take a chance on, you know, something in the $20 million a year range for an extension, and maybe you could go higher on a per year basis, but also have like a non-guarantee on the fourth year or something like that, or a guarantee that if he plays X number of games, it activates, something along those lines. That I think that would be fair. What do you think of that?
Well, something else to consider is that there's no chance he's going to qualify for like the Rose Rule or anything like that. So his maximum salary, based on what I can think about, isn't going to be that high. It's going to be like 25, 26 million, probably something in that range. And at that point, is it really worth the downside risk to commit to that now? Like, big whoop, it's another 5 million. Like, and that would require another team offering it. And remember, if another team makes that offer sheet, he's getting lower raises too. So I don't think that I would offer 20 million right now. I think I would be a little.
You would offer less, huh?
Yes. absolutely.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, it really is not that much more that they'd be saving. But and that is one thing that's kind of forgotten, too, is that they're like, oh, man, the Warriors, they saved so much on stuff. And they did. But, you know, Steph's max that year might have been like 13 or something to start. You know, and I guess actually that contract started at like, you know, 9.5 or something. But so they saved like $4 million a year. It wasn't like that much.
Because you could argue, oh, he's worth so much more than he got. But what he is worth is kind of immaterial when you consider that he couldn't have received so much more. I mean, those extensions that couple of years are just ridiculous.
All right. We about done here. Anything else you want to say?
Yeah, I can actually promote a couple things. One, my offseason preview for the Bucks is going to be on Sports Illustrated on Thursday. And also, pre-orders are available for my book. It is on Amazon. So it's on Amazon. I'm not going to read the whole title because it's long and I want to get the words exactly right. But if you search Daniel Rue on Amazon, it comes up, and that is the coolest thing in the world to say. That was even cooler than saying I have an author page at Sports Illustrated, and that was really cool. So
yeah,
very excited about that.
It's been a good year for us so far. If you would like to make it a better year for us, you could subscribe to our content at Patreon. Been posting the salary sheets that I've been using for these off-season previews there. Also, we did probably about one per month. Maybe we'll up it to two, depending on if we get more subscribers. The more subscribers we get, the more content we're going to want to put there, obviously. So we had a fun mailbag pod there as well. And also just if you want to support the Twitter NBA show, which is a free show, no commercials, other than us mentioning the Patreon way less than we should over the course of the 3-hour broadcast. Patreon.com/DuncanLarue is the way to do that. And we'll be back on Thursday night with Game 5 Twitter NBA show, Cavs Celtics. Talk to y'all then.